The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
There's a reason that we live so far from Hollywood. In the country, looking hard to find a home. With nothing perfect, dark and sin. So damn good. It's the story of your life. You're moving down the page, and you know you're on your way. The story of your life. You live it every day. You run, but you won't get away.
Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Here you do it. Inside the Beltway live on this Tuesday morning. So glad to be in your homes, in your cars. Thank you for having me. There's a debate tonight in Virginia between Glenn Youngkin and the old has-been washed up Terry McAuliffe. And I'm here to tell you that we are going to be already done voting. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I are going to vote today. There's early voting in Virginia. I'm going over to vote for Glenn Youngkin. I don't know why anyone would vote for Terry McAuliffe. Honest to goodness, it's just more taxes. And Virginia is already losing businesses and people to Tennessee and North Carolina and Florida and the rest of those places without taxes. And Terry McAuliffe wants to come in and get taxes. Terry McAuliffe is in pretty desperate shape. And I know that because yesterday a Democratic group began running ads slamming Glenn Youngkin for not having been endorsed by gun groups. That's right. Of course, Terry McAuliffe isn't endorsed by gun groups either. They're not endorsing. And that's because Glenn Youngkin is center-right conservative. Pretty good hunter, by the way. Knows firearms. Wouldn't fill out any checklist for any group, which is why he didn't get the endorsement. And therefore, Terry McAuliffe, who is desperate because he's falling behind in every poll, it's either gotten closer or closer, is now running ads, and Democratic groups are running ads accusing Glenn Youngkin of being soft on guns. That's just how Terry McAuliffe rolls. In fact, let's go to the first debate that they had and grab a clip from that where it sort of illustrates Glenn Youngkin's style and Terry McAuliffe's duplicity. Here it is, cut number 10 from their first debate.
First of all, he called me anti-vax. That's a lie. I am not anti-vax. In fact, he appointed a woman to the George Mason board that was absolutely anti-vax. And the only reason he did it is because she gave him hundreds of thousands of dollars for his campaign. His position flip-flops based on who's paying him. And in this case, I support the vaccine. I stand up for the vaccine.
Mr. Youngkin,
but I
your
respect
time is
individuals'
up.
Ability
we want to
make
on to
that
the
decision.
Next
the moderator worked hand in glove with Terry McAuliffe in the first debate, and Glenn Youngkin won anyway. And I'll be going off to vote for Glenn Youngkin today, regardless of what people say in the next hour. So I made up my mind. I'm voting for Glenn Youngkin. I want everyone to get out and vote for Glenn Youngkin early. It's the only smart thing to do. However, I want you to know that tonight's debate's being moderated by my friend, Chuck Todd. I expect he will be fair. He always is. And if with a fair moderator, Glenn Youngkin wins. Terry McAuliffe is showing his age. He's showing his old liberal stakes. Meanwhile, Democrats are in complete disarray. So the national context for the state of Virginia gubernatorial race is discussed with Joe Biden. The lead story this morning is the Taliban have announced. New Taliban chancellor of Kabul University announces women are banned. Tightening the Taliban's restriction on women, the group's new chancellor for Kabul University announced on Monday that women would be indefinitely banned from the institution, either as instructors or students. I give you my words, the Chancellor of Kabul University, Mohammad Ashraf Garat, said in a tweet Monday, as long as a real Islamic environment is not provided for all, women will not be welcome to the universities or work. Islam first. So the inevitability of Joe Biden's collapse, the inevitability of his incoherence, the inevitability of his infirmity has come home to roost. Later today, I taped an interview with John Andrzejczyk yesterday that we will play for you in hour number three today. All predictable. Joe Biden is responsible for this fiasco. And you should know that. And when you vote in the Virginia election, you should know that. You should also know that the Republicans stopped yesterday an absurd bill hiking the national debt that Democrats don't want to pass on their own to cover the massive, they have to attach it to their massive tax and spend bill, which is already running into trouble. Yesterday, they proposed a new 20% hike in a carbon tax. It's one of the most amazing taxes out of nowhere. They came up with this massive new tax. And they hadn't told anyone about it. They wanted to tax all carbon products, this massive new tax. And some of the moderate Democrats got together and said, you know, we're not really going to vote for that. So there's a deadlock. The Republicans, as expected, turned down the debt limit. Their accomplices in the media are trying very hard to make that appear to be a normal thing, to make that appear to be a Republican problem. It's not. The Democrats can't get their act together. They cannot make up their mind on what to do because the moderates and the progressives cannot agree. There are no moderates. The liberals and the leftists can't agree. That's the problem with the Democratic Party. The liberals and the leftists can't agree. Other news. Over at the landing page of the Washington Post, you'll find my new editorial on vaccines. Trust the doctors, not the internet. And I drew on my now decades-old experience with the Chad Green case, where Chad Green's parents simply would not allow modern medicine to treat Chad, four-year-old boy at the time. They eventually bolted from Mexico, took him to Mexico to try Laetril, and when they got to the Laetril, Chad Green died. And Dr. Truman, who I got to know a little bit when I was an undergraduate, just couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond the jurisdiction of the law. But the people who sold the greens on Laetril are like the people who are now selling you on anti-vaxxer stuff. Just don't believe it. The idea that Terry McAuliffe appointed an anti-vaxxer to the George Mason board. I want to play that one more time. This is from the last debate. Glenn Youngkin, cut number 10.
First of all, he called me anti-vax. That's a lie. I am not anti-vax. In fact, he appointed a woman to the George Mason board that was absolutely anti-vax. And the only reason he did it is because she gave him hundreds of thousands of dollars for his campaign. His position flip-flops based on who's paying him. And in this case, I support the vaccine. I stand up for the vaccine.
Mr. Youngkin,
but I respect individuals' ability to make that decision.
That is exactly right. Now, I want to play for you as well John Yarmuth, Democrat from Kentucky, chairman of the Budget Committee, talking yesterday about why the Democrats have so much problem putting together a massive tax and hike bill, but while in the end, they will get it done. Cut 17.
So then the question comes, if you can't find the resources to do it, what do you do? And this is part of a much longer topic that I'm not going to discuss today, but it's about making some recommendations. One is, we don't need to find ways to take money from people to pay for what we need to do for people. In this country, because we issue our own currency and because we borrow and spend in our own currency, we can pay for whatever we want to pay for. We just tell the Treasury to pay the bills. You write the checks when the bills come in. And you say, well, what about the debt? $28 trillion. Are we piling it on our grandkids? No, we're not. We're not. This is standard, I will say, conservative rhetoric. And even some Democrats parrot it. Well, we're putting it on our kids' credit card. We've been accumulating debt in this country for 230 years. Not one person has ever been asked to pay for his or her grandfather's promise.
Stop right there. They print the money. He just admitted it. In fact, the $28 trillion national debt was $20 trillion when the last year of the George Bush presidency began. And so in 13 years, we've doubled it, and Democrats are going to double it again in 5 years. Because they're simply, as John Yarmuth announced, attempting to print money. Here is the Post article on the climate tax, the $15 a ton on oil and gas producers, who they it says they'll get between $700 billion and $900 billion in new tax revenue that they can immediately spend in this bill. And all of the liberals in their caucus looked at the left-wing yo-hos and said, are you out of your mind? That's going to hit the middle class squarely in the gas bills and in the natural gas bills and their heating bills. Are you out of your mind? Because the left doesn't really understand how this works. Like John Yarmuth just said, why don't we just print the money? We're not spending your grandkids' money. Yes, they are. They're about to spend a whole much more of it, too. Stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you by
Carrie and Kirkman with Veritrone Omega. You cannot beat that. You need to take it every day, no matter if you're 14 or 94. Get out there, feel better every day, because you got the one natural supplement. The only supplement I take every single day is ReliefFactor.com. Where is the package? What have the Democrats decided to do? Because they're quarreling among themselves in the Republican Senate. It's your problem. You're running everything. Drucker is next to tell us on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined now by David Drucker. Drucker the Magnificent, Drucker, as we always call him, the author of a brand new book, which will be out soon. And when I get my copy, we'll spend a long time talking to Drucker about it. But right now, David Drucker, what are the Democrats going to agree to do? And we know it doesn't cost $0. I won't ask you to debunk their talking point. Where are they?
Well, I don't know if they know where they are. I mean, they have to solve a problem, which is they don't have the votes to do what they want to do. They only have the votes to do something else. And, of course, as you know, Hugh, I mean, and this is really, I think, a problem for Americans on both sides of the aisle. Everybody wants to spend money as long as they're not paid. So whenever you can present a bill as the other guy's paying for it, politically that goes a long way. But in the meantime, Democrats have to somebody's got to bite the bullet here. They've got a five-seat majority in the House. They've got a majority in the Senate only because they have the tie-breaking vote. It's not actually a majority. They don't have the votes to do what they'd like to do. And they're going to have to resolve these differences and accept the fact, which I'm sure the more knowledgeable, pragmatic members have internalized, but others may not have, that, you know, Republicans aren't really going to help them much.
And so they have to negotiate among themselves. Mitch McConnell, I played his remark. We're not voting for any of this, we being Republicans. And I'm a Republican, so I'm completely sympathetic to the leader. And McCarthy, there's not one vote anywhere. So they have to decide among themselves. Who is doing the deciding? Is Nancy Pelosi going back and forth between the liberals and the leftists trying to get to a yes? And is Chuck Schumer doing the same?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say at this point it's mostly Pelosi. I mean, I think Democrats in the Senate are mostly pragmatic about this, and that's why the bipartisan infrastructure bill was able to originate in the Senate. Remember, if House Democrats provide the votes for this, it passes, and Biden has a big, huge win. How it plays out in terms of, you know, how excited voters get is a different story. But, you know, presidents over the past, you know, decade or so, or at least recently, have been trying to pass a lot of infrastructure investment spending. And Biden is on the cusp of getting it. It's up to his party. But they have a Democratic majority, and they've got a Democratic president. And so a Democratic majority to deliver a Democratic president, a big, huge win on this, and they got 18 votes in the Senate. So Republicans did vote for something that they felt was worthwhile, and that could happen. You know, the big issue is this record.
But I want to pause and explain to the audience, David. We always get new affiliates. Okay. You're talking about the infrastructure bill, and that's the $1.5 trillion that would pass with bipartisan support. That's not good. That's not the $3.5 trillion.
To the Senate. Yeah, it doesn't have to go back to the Senate, is my point. So, you know, the big fight is over the word, we use the word reconciliation because it means it's not subject to a filibuster under certain rules. And so you've got this, they, you know, the Democrats, the progressives, they think they've already compromised. They wanted, you know, $6 gazillion and $6 trillion, and instead they're getting $3.5 trillion. And then obviously Senator Sinema and Manchin said nope. And they're all trying to figure out what to do here with this reconciliation package. And progressives believe that holding the bipartisan infrastructure package as leverage is their only way to get all this other massive spending they want. And Pelosi is trying to tell them, no, let's get this thing out so we have an achievement here. And it's also because the Democrats that are centrist or moderate or just not horribly, you know, hugely liberal are saying we don't want to do one and not the other. And so it's just a big mess. But I think Senate Democrats will end up going along with whatever the House sends them in terms of reconciliation. So they're not really the problem.
No. They the reconciliation is going to run into the brick wall. But
exactly.
The infrastructure, if they send over the infrastructure, they'll pass it, and they'll get 60
they
votes for it.
They don't even have to send it back, though. All they have to do is vote yes.
Right.
It goes right to Joe Biden's desk.
But they can't lose three votes. And I think that's the squad saying no, right?
Right now, it is more than the squad. Right now, it is the block of progressives or liberals, or whatever term you want to use, that is saying no. And you also have a block of centrists or moderates.
No, not on this show, David. There are liberals and leftists in the House with a D behind their name. There are no centrists.
I'm going to use my own terms. I'll call them pragmatic Democrats, pragmatic liberals, whatever. There's a block of them that don't want to do reconciliation first. They want to do bipartisan infrastructure first for a whole host of reasons. And they're also not in agreement with how progressives or liberals want to do things.
David, please. We got to not confuse the audience. There are Democrats. There are liberal Democrats and there are leftist Democrats. The liberal Democrats want infrastructure. The leftist Democrats want infrastructure, but they only want it with reconciliation. The liberal Democrats say no, pass the infrastructure bill. And the Senate Democrats are a mixture of 48 liberals, of 48 we'll pass anything and two liberals.
Look, Hugh, it's your show, so it's fine with me.
But they won't.
They can't agree amongst themselves, and that's the big problem.
That is, but will they eventually get to an answer this week, or is it going to be next week?
I tend to think they'll get there eventually, one way or the other. How and when, I'm not sure.
So do I. I think they will eventually screw the American people, but it ain't going to happen this week, I don't think. David Drucker of the Washington Examiner, thank you. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News joins me. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well, Hugh. Thank you.
So I just had a conversation with your colleague. I believe Democrats fall into two categories, liberals and leftists. There are no moderates. I mean, really, there isn't a pro-life Democrat out there left. There are no moderates. There are liberals, old-school Democrats, and then there are leftists, progressives, but leftists is their word. They can't agree. And so everything is stopped. They can't agree on what to do. Who's going to win that battle?
Well, here's what I think is going to happen. First of all, this $1.1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure thing passed from the Senate weeks ago. The House could always just pass it in 10 minutes if they wanted. It was just sitting there. $1 trillion just sitting on the table. All you got to do is pick it up and put it in your pocket. They're going to do it. And the news this morning is Nancy Pelosi has decoupled that from this demand to pass $3.5 trillion in social and climate spending. And remember, President Biden caused kind of a ruckus when he came out and said that they had to be passed together, even though the Senate had just passed this bill. The House would not pass it until they also passed the $3.5 trillion. They've given up on that, okay? So they're going to take the money because they'd be insane not to. Then the $3.5 trillion appears to be just murky at the moment. We don't know what the two, Manchin and Sinema, and other Democrats think, what their final position is. The Democrats are running into the problem they've always had, which is they do not control a majority of seats in the Senate. And it's, you can't get New Deal-size legislation done without even a bare Senate majority. Last thing is, Congress operates really only in a crisis. Remember back when the economy collapsed, they passed TARP in about 10 minutes. I mean, they could pass a $1 trillion bill, you know, before the end of your show if they wanted to. So they wait until things become a crisis. So they are going to have to pass something to keep the government funded for some period of time, and then something to
extend the debt ceiling. Yeah.
And if I could continue my monologue for one more moment. If you look at a Politico poll from yesterday, this is a classic question. If there was a U.S. government shutdown, would you tend to blame the Democratic Party more, the Republican Party more, or both parties equally? This time in this poll, Democrats 32%, Republicans 24%. Both parties equally was 36. Now, that was different in 2018 when Republicans controlled Congress. Same question. Republicans, I think, 41%. Democrats, maybe 35%. So Democrats are in charge. People know that. They're going to get the blame if the government can't keep funded. And so they are going to give in and fund the government.
They will fund the government next week, but then they have to pass a debt limit. They're going to have to fund the government with a clean CR. Unless, I suppose they could attach the debt limit to the infrastructure bill, but I don't think it'll pass then. I think they'll lose their Republican vote. So they've got to amend the budget resolution to allow for reconciliation, to allow for a debt limit. When they're done with that, they have to come back and do part two. Part one's the trillion. So I hear you saying Pelosi's going to send that forward today. Is that the latest reporting?
I believe it's Thursday. It's supposed to. She'll put it up for a vote.
And will they lose four socialists? I mean, they've got four socialists at least. That's to the left of the leftists.
Yeah. I agree with your liberals and leftists distinction. I mean, I always feel kind of funny writing the phrase Democratic moderates.
There aren't leftists. Any. Yeah, there aren't any.
And so I agree with that. And so I believe this fight between Pelosi and the squad, which is kind of symbolic of her problems with some of the progressives, is something that's basically going to disappear. I do not think the progressives are going to kill a $1.1 trillion spending bill, all of which they support, in favor of some $6 trillion Shangri-La that they want to pass sometime in the future. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, hostage taking doesn't work unless you're willing to slit the throat of your victim.
Yeah,
and they're not willing to here.
Right. They're pointing a gun to their own heads and say, don't do that or I'll shoot.
Right.
It's crazy.
So the $1 trillion gets through, the CR stripped of the debt limit gets through, and then we're back to about 3 weeks of negotiation on what to do about the $3.5 trillion. And that comes back to Sinema, Manchin, and Hassan.
Yeah, and now you remember Manchin is saying, we don't need to really do this year. This is not something that's absolutely critical this year. I think that scares a lot of Democrats. But the fact is, they don't control a majority of seats in the Senate. If they had 54 votes in the Senate, they, first of all, the chances of crafting something to pick up six Republicans and make it past a filibuster would be much more possible than it is 50. But in any event, they could lose a couple of votes and still get something through with a bare majority. But they don't. That dictates everything that happens in the Senate. the fact that the so-called majority party does not control a majority of seats.
All right, now I want to turn to Virginia. I don't know if you vote in Virginia, Byron. I do. I'm going to vote early today. I'm not going to wait for the second debate. Chuck Todd is moderating it from NBC News. I think Glenn Youngkin will win two in a row because Terry McAuliffe, boy, does he look old. And it's just kind of the same old thing. But when Terry McAuliffe starts buying ads accusing Glenn Youngkin of being soft on guns, I think he's in trouble. What do you think?
Well, this is, first of all, it's interesting. I do not vote in Virginia, but the race is clearly pretty much a toss-up at the moment, if not Youngkin ahead. So it's changed. And I don't know if you've been talking about this story from Axios that we've seen, but there have been some ads in Virginia accusing Youngkin of being soft on the Second Amendment.
Yes.
Bad on guns. And Axios reports that this is these ads are coming from a Democratic PAC, that the donation page is controlled by Act Blue, that it was incorporated in Virginia by a Democratic group, and its other ads on Snapchat are purchased by a Democratic purchasing group. So this indicates a little, this is a dirty trick. It indicates
dirty trick.
A little desperation.
A lot of desperation.
On the Democratic side.
Yeah, this is, to me, it's the tell. They got to twitch, right? And when you start twitching and doing stuff like this, it's a poker tell. And it tells me that their internals are bad, that Terry is old, tired, that Biden is old and tired, and that Biden being old and tired, and the Afghanistan debacle. Especially Virginia, people forget Virginia is a military state. And if anybody is upset with the, you know, just today's story is that Kabul University has been closed to women. If anybody is pro women in Virginia or pro military, they're not going to vote for Terry McAuliffe after this debacle in Afghanistan, Byron York. It's not going to happen. So does this debate tonight matter, the one that Chuck Todd is moderating?
Not as much. I mean, I think that the fundamentals of the race are pretty clear. But here's what's going to happen. McAuliffe is going to try to connect Youngkin to Donald Trump and say how terrible Donald Trump is over and over and over and over. So that's what's going to happen. So if you believe that A, Donald Trump is terrible, and B, Glenn Youngkin is just like him or is going to be in thrall of Donald Trump, then you can vote for Terry McAuliffe. But I think this trick only, you know, they are kind of a one-trick pony here, and I think it only goes so far. And in the first debate, Youngkin was pretty strong and has maintained his independence, and so I don't think that's going to change.
You know, I don't expect Chuck also to fall for the Donald Trump thing. I don't think he will allow. The first moderator was just in the bag for McAuliffe, just a Democrat in the bag for McAuliffe, and they kept bringing up Trump. I don't think Chuck's going to fall for that stuff. This is a Virginia race about Virginia taxes, Virginia education, critical race theory in Loudoun County. They don't want to talk about it, right? The Democrats don't want to talk about critical race theory, but it's everywhere in Virginia. It's driving the election in a large regard. We will see. Byron, we will see. Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Fox News. Always a pleasure, Byron. Come right back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt on a Tuesday, Inside the Beltway, live. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com.
somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ship.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Joined now by my friend Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, chairman of all sorts of things, member of the Carlyle Group. Admiral Stav, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, Hugh. Up in Long Island today, as a matter of fact. Did a speech last night at a bank here.
Out and around again. I'm glad to hear it. I have two questions for you. The Taliban have closed Kabul University to women. This is not surprising. Yesterday, they hung four people from cranes. That's not surprising. What we see happening out of there will continue to get worse and will roll out over the days and weeks and months ahead. My question is, are you still in touch with some of the Pineapple Express people? There are a lot of veterans who are working to get a lot of people out of Afghanistan. They're calling in every chit around town that I know of. Everyone is getting asked by these people to help, and everyone's trying to help. I assume you're getting those calls, too. How wise do you think it is for the vets to be there working sub-rosa to get people out?
Oh, I think it's additive, and we've got to keep at it. And let's face it, nobody is going to be more passionate about getting at-risk Afghans than the Americans who worked alongside those Afghans. And, you know, we often use the shorthand interpreter, but it's vast number of people, 100,000 plus, maybe 200,000 when you add in them and their families, who were interpreters, logisticians, frontline soldiers, commandos, helicopter pilots. It's the entire gamut of Afghans who stood with us, and we have a deep moral obligation to get them out. And yes, I know dozens of veterans who are involved in this. Some are more successful than others. There are a wide variety of ways in which they're trying to help these people. And I think it'll be additive to what the U.S. government needs to be doing, which I assume is being directed largely by the CIA at this point, because I don't see the Department of Defense publicly, visibly going after this. I think that, to conclude, I think that Lloyd Austin and Mark Milley will be asked about that in public testimony today. What are you doing to get people out of Afghanistan?
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about what they might say today and tomorrow, but we will next week. I do want to talk about what the Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, said at the UN yesterday. He said, words don't stop centrifuges spinning. Many people believe when he said that Iran's nuclear weapons program is at a critical point, that he meant it's at a point where Israel either acts or Iran gets the bomb. How do you read that, Admiral Stav?
I think you've got it roughly right. We could probably have a discussion about whether it's this minute or whether it's 6 months from now or at the outside a year from now. But Israel has always been very clear that they will not tolerate in Iran that can sprint to a nuclear weapon, and nor should they. It's an existential threat in every dimension to Israel. And, oh, by the way, it's not just a nuclear weapon. Iran already has a profound ballistic missile capability, which can overwhelm the Israeli, even the Israeli vaunted missile defense system. So Israel has plans to conduct such strikes. They would rather see a diplomatic and non-combat solution, but they're not going to tolerate an Iranian capability to sprint. I'll define that as less than 6 months to get to a nuclear weapon. Iran is probably approaching that point now.
So when they get to that point, when they hit the breakout moment, what do you expect Israel to do, and what will the United States do to help or hinder Israel?
I think the Israelis will take military action. They will probably, before they go to an overt strike capability use, they will probably attempt more clandestine. In other words, as they have shown us, they clearly have, if you will, boots on the ground, plenty of capability inside Iran. They'll probably try and do something smaller scale from the inside. But failing that, if they don't have the means to get inside those Iranian facilities, particularly the centrifuge farms, then I think you're going to see them launch a major attack. It could come from long-range missiles, long-range airstrike. They have all the capability to do that. What the U.S. will be faced with is a choice of whether to provide critical intelligence, to provide the ability to move those forces forward, air tanking, all those kinds of things. I think that'll be a choice that the Biden administration is hoping not to face. But at the end of the day, we, the United States, cannot tolerate Iran having that nuclear breakout capability.
It is widely believed, though I cannot confirm it, that Israel provided us with notice of the Iranian intent to strike al-Assad with ballistic missiles, which they did following the assassination of Soleimani. So they have obviously great intel there. What sort of intel would we be providing them, Admiral? But stuff that they don't have eyes in the sky, because the Israelis have got lots of eyes in the sky.
They do, but they don't have our satellite systems. They have very good internal sources in Iran, but we are quite capable of gathering intelligence ourselves, human. We have signals intelligence, in particular, the ability to collect on cell phones and cyber capabilities. I don't want to go into great depth here for purposes of classification, but suffice to say, yes, Israel has excellent intelligence. We have excellent intelligence. You know, the thing about intelligence, Hugh, is it's not like a painted picture. It's like a mosaic, and different actors will bring different chips to the mosaic. And by the way, it perhaps will not be just the United States and Israel. The Saudis have very good capability. The UAE does. The Qataris. So when you want to put that picture together, remember it's a mosaic. We can help that picture be filled out for the Israelis if we choose to do so.
Would it be wave after wave after wave of Israeli jets flying to a variety? Because when the precursor of this, which was the attack on the Iraqi nuclear weapons program in the 80s, occurred, it was one elaborate strike, and they couldn't fly over certain Arab lands that they would be allowed overflight now. And they couldn't fly over Iraq, which would probably, they were aiming at Iraq. I don't know what Iraq would say now about overflights. What do you think, Admiral? Is it as an elaborate an attack as happened last time?
I think that the Israelis will want to be as precise as they can possibly be. They'll also be highly creative here. In other words, Hugh, it will probably be long-range missiles in combination with manned aircraft, in combination with offensive cyber capability, for example, to blunt Iranian air defense systems, in combination with internal boots on the ground, taking out particular nodes physically. It'll be a combined, sophisticated plan. It's not going to be a single rifle shot. It'll be all those elements coming together. And, of course, they're not aiming to take out every Iranian production facility in the entire country of Iran, which is vast. They'll be very precision-guided in what they go after, and they'll want to do the maximum damage and push Iranian capability to get to the bomb back as far as they possibly can. At the heart of it, of course, is the enriched uranium and the centrifuges that produce that weapons grade of the uranium.
So, Admiral, long ago, the chief of staff, then chief of staff to General Mattis when he was running the MEF out of Camp Pendleton, his name was Colonel Clark Lethane, said to me, the problem with civilians, Hugh, is you never think about second and third order consequences. And I always remember that. What will be the second and third order consequences of the strike that Bennett at the UN was hinting at yesterday?
Well, they will be directed in the immediate moment at Israel itself. And it would be principally Hezbollah, which is a terrorist organization that has embedded itself in southern Lebanon in possession of tens of thousands of surface-to-surface missiles. Some of those are very short range. Some can go all the way down south to the Israeli facilities in the desert. And I think you would see in the immediate moment a rain of those missiles coming in. Israel would be ground zero for those attacks. Secondly, Iran would launch its own ballistic missiles, conventional ballistic missiles, principally at Israel. If the Iranians could tie Saudi cooperation or Gulf state cooperation to the strike, say overflight, you might see reactions against the Saudi oil fields, and you could see the Iranians decide to dump thousands of mines into the Strait of Hormuz. That would be just the initial few days. Then you'd see, I think, targeted assassination attempts to the degree the U.S. was involved. There'd be actions directed against the U.S. globally. Iran and Hezbollah have a very robust terrorist organization. So, yeah, second, third-order effects would be coming. And, oh, by the way, with all respect to the colonel, I've met a lot of civilians who are smart enough to think through second- and third-order effects. I know that the Biden administration is doing that, and that's a principal reason they're hoping to avoid the need for that kind of strike through diplomacy.
But there is only – there comes a point where you have to recognize, I think, that the – not you, Admiral, but generally – that we have to recognize that Iran is not going to be deterred. And when that point comes and they cross over the breakout line, Israel's going to act. I was just curious if you thought among the second order impacts, a ground invasion of Lebanon coordinate with the strikes on Iran would occur so as to preempt as much of the Hezbollah rocketry as possible.
I think that's a possibility. And let's face it, the Israelis, who have a finely tuned war machine in their own armed forces, would not have to commit ground troops to invading Iran. So their army would be available, if you will, for that kind of mission. Let's hope we don't get there. But to your point, if you're an Israeli, and this is why Naftali Bennett said those words at the UNGA, the United Nations General Assembly, you know, we all want to be Sun Tzu, right? The great Asian strategist, that the greatest battle is the one you never actually fight. He's all about diplomacy and head fakes and figuring out a clever way to win. But Sun Tzu also said, when on death ground, fight. And what he meant by that was, when someone is going to kill you and you are on your death ground, you have to fight. And I think that's how Israel feels about an Iranian nuclear weapon.
Perfect bow on it. Thank you very much, Admiral James Stavridis. Follow him on Twitter, by the way, at Stavridis, if you want him to speak to your group, Washington Speakers Bureau.
Hear the latest reporting and analysis on the big stories of the day on the Daybreak Insider podcast. It's top-notch reporting from SRN News, along with the sharpest insight from Hugh Hewitt, Mike Gallagher, Dennis Prager, Sebastian Gorka, and the voices of townhall.com. The Daybreak Insider podcast. It's your first look at today's top stories. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and at SalemPodcastNetwork.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.